Our direct impact on our planet can most effectively be seen and measured via our built spaces. How intentional have those environments, those spaces, been designed and placed? Was the health of the planet factored into the designing and building process? How about our own health? Our guest today is an architect and urban designer, and her work emphasizes principles of collaboration and public engagement, especially focusing on the intersection of design and public health. Hello, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Impact Earth Innovation. I'm really, really excited to have as our guest today, Michael Pride. She is a professor of architecture at the University of New Mexico, the director of DPAC, which stands for Design and Planning Assistance Center at UNM, and special assistant to the Dean for Equity and Excellence. As an architect and urban designer, Michael emphasizes principles of collaboration and public engagement in her teaching, research, and professional consulting. Her current work focuses on the intersection of design and public health, seeking ways to create healthier and more equitable communities. Michael, when I say I'm thrilled to have you here, it's been like this big crescendo because I'm friends with Mike Franks, which I'm going to tell you a little bit of a backstory about that. But in this journey of Mrs. Green's world and of learning, Mike helped bring to my focus the importance and relevance of the built environment and its impact on us and the planet. And I have lots of questions, but the backstory is Mike's been a friend for like over 30 years, a fellow Rotarian, and he was one of the very first companies that stepped up to be a sponsor of Mrs. Green's World. And he really pays attention. It's not because, you know, I like Gina. He really likes to know what we're up to. And at our last partnership renewal meeting, he literally stopped me dead in my tracks, calling me out about what was totally missing from our platform. And that was talking about the importance of the built environment. And I looked at him and I went, huh? What are you talking about? We're missing something. And he explained it to me. He had very detailed notes. And he said, think about it, Gina. Where do people spend most of their time? In their office or in their home. They're in a built environment. And I'm very appreciative that he did call us out, and then he connected us with you. And then what I found out this morning is that you are Debbie's roommate, his wife. So it's like it's a family affair now. And he said, oh, Gina, this is what he said this morning. He goes, oh, Gina, she's a total rock star. And I said to him, I knew that because I did a lot of research, Mike. So we're really, really excited. And we thank Mike for his sponsorship and his support of us and for helping open our eyes about this. And now, like, we're on it. It seems like every meeting I go to, they're talking about the built environment. So let's start with that. Because now that Chatty Cathy is finished, this is all about you. But how would you describe what is meant by the built environment? How do you describe the concept to lay people?
The built environment is, I think, as Mike mentioned to you, it's where we spend most of our time. It's all of those constructed spaces and places that we essentially, as human people, as human beings, created for our comfort, for our productivity, and for our survival, essentially. So it started with shelter, but it's extended to everything from elaborate institutional buildings to wonderfully organized experiences of national parks or even just your neighborhood park.
So I'm kind of curious about the conversation around the built environment and how it really is coming into its own. People are, it's a word that are used. We had people on from the University of Arizona. And I guess the big surprise to me that makes so much sense, but we don't think about it, is how can the built environment, especially the work environment, I would say, and of course the home to some extent, how can it impact our health and our overall well-being?
Well, it's really interesting, Gina. As you said, the topic of the built environment has is becoming more and more present in multiple venues. So whether we're talking about public health or we're talking about environmental health, we're realizing scholars from the sciences, from public health professions and disciplines, from medical disciplines, are now finding their work landing in the built environment. And so I feel really fortunate that public health scholars have found their way to the built environment and have conducted really robust and irrefutable studies demonstrating the link between the design of the built environment at all scales to multiple different health outcomes. So, for instance, chronic disease is on the rise. And as a matter of fact, you may have heard the reports in the last couple of weeks determining that that cancer is growing faster in developed countries than anywhere else in the world, and that it's really on the rise, a rapid rise. On the other hand, infectious disease has really been managed very well, and that we can attribute to a couple of things. One is that we all feel very aware of vaccinations, medications, and better healthcare. But what is less visible and obvious today is how much managing our built environment also contributed to reducing infectious disease. For instance, sewer systems and sanitation generally have helped manage infectious disease, especially things like malaria or tuberculosis or respiratory infections, things like that, that spread from person to person, whether it's through the air, through the water, or through our sewage systems. And now we are seeing more chronic disease, like diabetes and high blood pressure, heart disease. And these are related to, or correlated to physical activity, for example, and air quality. And when we suffer in those areas, we realize the episodes, the presence and prevalence of heart disease and diabetes are much greater, yes, among people who have very little physical activity, but especially among people with low incomes and people of color, who very often live in environments where it's either unsafe or uncomfortable to be physically active. This is where the expression comes from, that your zip code is a better determinant of your life expectancy than your genetic code.
Yeah, I got chills with that one, and so true. And even the relevance of the timing for this interview is so, I'm always blown away by what happens a couple of days before an interview. And we had someone present to a green team for one of my other partners here in Tucson, and she was from Tucson Clean and Beautiful, talking about the importance of planting more trees and how that, you know, reduces the heat island and on and on. And also, and Michael, it's the same thing. In the lower income areas, she showed a grid and it would blow you away. Like, you know, north of Broadway, lots of trees. South side, not so much. So the trees help filter the air. It creates, you know, lower temperatures. I mean, and your concept that I've read about, it takes all of those things into consideration. It's not just a building. Is that a fair assessment of your work?
Very fair assessment. As you mentioned, my graduate work is in urban design, and that's where I really center my practice these days. And so it's all of the factors put together, the buildings themselves, the streets, the sidewalks, the parks and open space, the relationship between all of these elements, that's our built environment. And that's the scale at which urban designers are most concerned. And it is, of course, the combination of these features and factors that create a healthier or less healthy environment, a neighborhood, a community.
I remember about 4 years ago, maybe, there was a downtown lecture series put on by the University of Arizona, and Esther Sternberg spoke. And she is a big, nationally, internationally recognized person about a sense of place. And Michael, she showed graphs of recovery rates for people in assisted living, their overall well-being, depending upon the lighting in the room and if they had a view of a tree. I am not kidding. Yeah. I was like, what? You got to be kidding. Like, yes. they got better faster in hospital rooms. I mean, all of that combined, which, you know, you just don't go around thinking about that. The average person does not go around thinking, I got better because I could see a tree. But the research, yeah. The recovery periods are shorter. So it's, when I said I was excited about interviewing you, there's so many pieces to this that excite me. And does it matter how much light there is in a building and the air filtration system and the comfort, you know, the comfort level of the temperature? All those factors are related directly to the built environment, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm so glad you mentioned medical recovery or recovery times, because this is an area that has been well studied. So it's really evidence-based design. What's come out recently is, I'm going to put these in a basket, and that is well known in public health scholarship as social determinants of health. And these are all of those factors outside of your body and outside of the medical system that have an impact on your health. And they've actually collectively contribute, I think it's something like 75% of your health. Whereas the healthcare itself, when you go to the doctor and you get seen as an individual, is about 25%. And so you can see why some medical experts and leaders around the country are saying, we need to take care of these other factors in order to do a better job of managing the health of our communities. So social determinants of health, these include things like access to medical care, not just the care that you get, but right. The ability to go get some, housing, transportation, education, jobs, and also those kind of inherited factors like gender, race, ethnicity, et cetera. And of course, maybe some people are born with disabilities or acquire them, but all of these factors are contributors.
And in our community, it's like we, on our show, we used to say, we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And as I was preparing for the show, I spent hours clicking on links and reading more and educating myself more so that I would think. Because some of these things, Michael, they're not obvious observations, even for someone that I feel like I am, which is I'm really committed to, you know, equity, inclusion, diversity, learning every day what that means as a person born with white privilege, how I can up my game in terms of awareness. So you talk about, first of all, a statistic I can give you is the third leading cause of death in Pima County is upper respiratory disease. And it's everything mm-hmm. you said. It's older people and younger kids, typically in lower income housing. It's the air they breathe. It might be the toxins in their home. I never even thought about the sewers and how that's controlled. So everybody should pay attention. If you have an elderly person in your life or a young child, they're dying because of things like this. I mean, talk about an impact on your health. So to me, the perfect segue here is you're not just a big believer in, but you have really gotten lots of people engaged in what you call community engaged design. And I read one example that just stood out. And you had a group of people on a busy street, and you saw this man running across four lanes of traffic. And you pointed out it's a huge risk for anyone crossing a busy intersection. So educate a little bit about what do you do about that? Like, why? I said, wow, you're right. You shouldn't be running across four lanes of highway. And we have a very high pedestrian mortality rate where I live. So can you talk about what you mean by community engaged design and what that looks like?
Sure. So that you point out this pedestrian injury factor, which is a growing problem, and I believe is an impact of our very auto-oriented city design, which was built for speed and going through places, not to places, right? So what we find are these big four-lane roads. They're not only four lanes, but then we remove curbside parking to make more room for cars that are moving. And the distance that one has to travel as a pedestrian to cross a street gets longer and longer. You have all this distance to cover. You have a street that's designed for speed, and you have perhaps drivers who have reason to believe that they have priority on the road and little expectation of a pedestrian
right
in that road. In fact, even the width of the lanes makes a difference. We call this now design speed. And narrower lanes, streets that have cars parked on one or both sides, trees perhaps, other things that start to make it feel like a smaller room, you mentally, automatically, subconsciously drive more slowly. And when lanes are wider and the streets are wider and more open, like we see in suburban commercial strips, corridors, you will drive more quickly, even though there may be pedestrians. So how does this relate to community engaged design? And in this one case I want to bring up is before my time in Albuquerque, but a community-based group organized a health impact assessment, and HIAs are becoming more popular, and I mean more well-known and right, more used in more communities. HIAs, in their intention, are to be kind of stakeholder-based, community-based operations where residents, business owners, et cetera, take a direct and active part in assessing their communities, especially related to a proposed policy. Here in the International District of Albuquerque, the International District Healthy Communities Coalition took upon an expanded or more holistic HIA process called Health in All Policies, and they identified pedestrian and bicyclist injury as one of their number one concerns. And in doing so, residents, youth, young residents, their parents, their grandparents all participated in observation and study of their own neighborhoods and found that these wider streets were where more injuries were happening, more crashes generally, and that it was street design. So they've been advocating for street redesign, striping for narrower lanes. Medians are often used at least to create a refuge for a pedestrian on their way across a multi-lane road. and also narrowing in at crosswalks so that that distance is shorter. But I believe everything starts with, you know, community members are experts in their community. They know much more about what's happening, what has happened, where the trouble spots are, where the feel-good places are. They have attachment to those areas, and they really want a good quality of life. So we need to tap into that expertise as we go about trying to help, whether it's local government or consultants or agencies, nonprofits, or neighborhood associations make those improvements and changes in their neighborhoods.
So let me ask you a question, and I'm laughing at myself. It's one of my gifts. I have an ability to totally laugh at myself and make it public.
It's a really good
but
one.
I'll tell you this. So in some of our neighborhoods here, they put in those circles right in the middle of the neighborhoods. And when I'm going around, I'm saying, oh my gosh, this is so annoying. Well, lately, I've evolved, okay? Now that I know the reason is to help slow things down. Is it crazy for me to assume, because I've really noticed the more, that can those circles, just those circles, create more of a sense of community? And I say that because when I notice them now and don't get annoyed and say, what's your hurry? You're going to get there 30 seconds faster, which matters to no one ever, that people decorate them. And they put flowers in them, and they put pumpkins in them for Halloween. Not all of them, but there is a sense of community, and more the ones I see, they're delightful. So can the community design factor actually help to create the health of a community in terms of like the joy factor or the wellness factor, or is that like just crazy Gina loving this decorations?
Well, I love that people in your neighborhood are decorating their traffic circles.
They are. And in neighborhoods.
And I think it's something which is great. And hopefully, I mean, I'm assuming it's kind of spontaneous and grassroots organizing, which is really lovely.
Yes.
I appreciate taking cues for my work from the kind of incumbent actions of residents. So I would say if we make that median large enough for someone to decorate and don't prohibit their decorating it.
Right, right. There will be an ordinance about that. I know.
Yes, we need to let it happen. I've also seen kind of commissioned public art, but what about having community members involved in selecting that art and working directly with artists and perhaps even co-creating that work, I think it can be really lovely results that help express identity of a neighborhood and attachment, all of those things, pride, I think, which everybody wants to feel about their neighborhood,
yes.
Right? So love that. I love that idea that the traffic circles become a part of that system of identity and attachment.
And who doesn't like a tree? I mean, if you do, you shouldn't admit it. If you don't, you shouldn't admit it. That's how I feel. If you don't get it, the importance of a tree, and hearing that presentation yesterday of, you know, it helps with cut carbon emissions. It helps with the heat island. It's a habitat for birds and butterflies. And there's just no downside to trees. And here in the desert Southwest, there are beautiful trees that can be planted that are flowering, that help with the monarch butterfly. I mean, you just don't think about the contribution to the quality of our life that a single tree can have. And it's...
Oh, absolutely. Just to add food. If it's also fruit-bearing,
yes,
then you get food from it. And it's interesting because years ago when I first got involved in urban and community design projects, they were in like little neighborhood hubs, commercial centers, and what I would hear is retailers don't want street trees because then you can't see their business sign, which is crazy.
Whatever is what I want to say.
Especially in the desert Southwest.
Come on.
You'll see a lot more people walking around. Well, it's a car orientation that you can't see the business while you're driving 45 miles per hour down a commercial street. But now, I think that talk has really calmed down. We understand through things like the Main Street program organized by the National Park Service that things like trees, street lighting, paving, other things make those environments much more comfortable and attractive for people to walk around. And when they're walking, there's a much better chance of them actually walking in your front door and perhaps even purchasing something. When you think about the places all around the world we might choose to visit, they're not typically highways with commercial strip centers with 200 feet deep of parking between the sidewalk and the storefront. Are they?
No, it's like, oh, I want to go on vacation and see a lot of strip malls. I mean, Please, said no one ever, I hope. But you're right. It's you're called, and even all of these downtown, the whole revitalization of cities all over the world. Look at what Denver did. Look at what Austin did. Tucson is on its way. We're doing so much better in the past 5 years. People want to go downtown, and they don't drive their cars around there. You park somewhere, and you walk all over the place. And it makes you feel good about your community.
Exactly. So it's what is really encouraging for me is how both the science coming from public health scholars, from even traffic engineers, don't pass out, and others are all coming together, and not to mention the environmental scientists, that actually beautiful places are healthier for humans and for the planet. And it justifies my whole profession, that beautiful places really matter, not just building to accommodate, building to shelter, but actually building to uplift our spirits, to make us smile, to make us happy, but also safer, is really amazing to me. So you're also much more likely to walk further and more often if your streets, one, have some kind of pedestrian facility, whether it's a sidewalk or a well-maintained trail,
right,
or even a bike lane. It has trees so that you feel sheltered from the sun and you're cooler. And there's actually some place to go, a destination, right? Whether it's a coffee shop or a park, playground, something like that. Those things keep us more active, keep us more engaged with our own health, but also keep us more engaged with each other.
Yes.
Social isolation is one of the key social determinants of health. So this is another reason why we see elderly suffering more than we might think, unexpectedly, is very often they become kind of, through their reduced ability, maybe no longer working, become more isolated and less social. And, they're much more likely to die alone in their homes than those who going to a bridge club, walking with friends and neighbors every week, whatever it is. So these are the key factors that I think design can support. The social isolation or social connection, which is more important.
Right, right.
Access to nature. You were talking about the trees, whether your view of a tree outside of your hospital room or even a photograph of a natural landscape, as a matter of fact, and physical activity. Those three things are really, they're key social determinants of health. They make our lives better, and we have positive impacts on our health. And those are things we can build and design for.
There's just no downside. I mean, there is just no downside. And in many cases, it doesn't even cost more money. It's having the consciousness and the intention before you're into the build phase, you know, in the design phase that, and to me, Mike, what I love is it's not something where you drive down the street and you say, oh, look at those trees, I feel better. It just happens for you. You don't even have to think about it. There's a whole lightning of that. And I want to totally switch subjects, but not really, because it's all about, to me, the whole sense of community consciousness. And Mike and I talked about it this morning, too, because I said to him, did you know that she's working on blah, blah, blah? And he goes, I did. So a segue that we have to talk about and taking it to another level is, are you ready? It's about toilets and your passion.
I knew that was coming.
It's coming, and it's coming. And my personal story is that our public libraries, they are open to the homeless, and I applaud it. Every time I go, I'm conscious, I look around. It's touched my life more than I ever thought it would because of one of my best friends whose daughter is choosing to be homeless. She has severe mental health issues, and she uses a library to go to the bathroom, to wash her face, to charge her phone. So I will tell you, and Mike said it, he said, you know, these are things that we don't go around thinking about. We don't. I don't think ever about where I have to go to the bathroom because and I'm just going to say it again, white privilege, I can beg to use someone's bathroom even if they say it's not for customers. It's like there's a restaurant. I can put on my sad face if I really have to go. So let's get down in the weeds here. So tell us about your quote. I loved it. Going to the bathroom is something everyone does. So you have a collaboration. You didn't just bring it to our attention with UNM, the Hive Network. And I want you to take it to a deeper level because it isn't just a kind, nice thing to do. Oh, let's give the homeless a public toilet. It can impact our health incredibly and the health of the people working with homeless. So take it away, Michael, about public toilets and why they matter.
Public toilets. Yes. I love being able to say poop on radio and TV.
I do too. So, I loved it. I'm like, this is lighting me up, man. We're going to talk about this.
Well, you're right, Gina. So many of us don't have to think about this on a regular basis. We all have to think about it at some point because we all go. I love the kids' book, Everybody Poops.
I just bought it for my granddaughter. And she's only 4 months old. But I'm like, okay, she's got to have that book.
That's right. Got to be on the shelf when she's ready.
Right.
However, we actually criminalize this very human function in people who are unhoused. And that, to me, is criminal. It's an injustice, for sure. We're so uncomfortable with, being close to people who are struggling. We're uncomfortable with misery and misfortune. And we also find it a nuisance, I think, as a society, right? A nuisance of people maybe smelling bad or peeing or pooping in your alley or in your yard, not to mention at a storefront or something like that.
Or behind businesses. I mean, Mike said it's something he struggles with because of where his office is.
Definitely, yes, behind businesses. And, you know, it's not like people set out to say, whose business am I going to defile today?
Right, right.
They have no other choices. We've removed public restrooms from parks. We've prohibited access to public toilets or to toilets for people we filter, right? Who's going to have access to toilets? We lock them at 5 or 6 o'clock at night, but people have to pee and poop pretty much 24/7.
24/7.
When the street is your shelter, it's so much worse. And we've started to call this kind of a dignity project. The Hive at UNM is an acronym. It's a network of scholars, students, staff, and increasingly community partners that are unified under the umbrella of social determinants of health and for addressing inequities in this area. The acronym stands for Health, Inclusion, Vibrancy, and Equity. And through other partners in the Hive Network, specifically on the medical side, we met members of our new mayoral administration in Albuquerque under Tim Keller, the mayor, and the Office of Behavioral Health and Wellness. And Mayor Keller really has homelessness as one of his priorities, addressing homelessness in very positive ways, rather than, I mean, you can imagine some cities have addressed homelessness by giving unhoused people vouchers for transportation to other cities or whisk them off to the outskirts of town. But I think this administration really believes on a kind of dignity platform. At any rate, we learned of some problems in at least one public park in particular and around restrooms, and that kind of stimulated a whole bunch of work. And one of our DPAC studios we at UNM houses one of the oldest university-based community design centers in the country. And we host an interdisciplinary design studio every spring. So last spring, we decided to take on the issue of public toilets. And what we really found in our discussions with all these different stakeholders, whether it was Parks and Recreation Department, behavioral health, environmental health, police, fire, et cetera, there were a couple of things. One, for sure, is Albuquerque, like some other cities, have experienced a hepatitis outbreak related to sanitation and hygiene.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Like, bam.
And so, yes. So it truly, that's an obvious, direct, immediate, and tragic health issue related to toilets, access to toilets and hand washing. So it's that kind of issue in Albuquerque. We also learned, and we came to understand, that it's not just people who are unhoused that need toilets, of course, but may find themselves with limited access. For instance, we were talking about the elderly earlier. You know, my understanding is, I'm working my way towards this, not quite there yet, where elderly actually may need to access restrooms more often. Children, you mentioned your granddaughter, who's been with kids in a park or someplace when suddenly a kid goes, I have to go.
Right. And they mean now.
And they yes. really do mean now. And, you know, we have grandchildren living with us now. And it's just like, oh, my gosh, why didn't you think of that before? So, and travelers, how about you're away from home? Maybe thousands of miles, maybe just 3 miles at a park. And there's no facilities, you got to figure it out. So, and even families will hesitate to go to a public park if there are no facilities. Right. So, you know, so then who's left using the parks? I mean, it's just, it's many ripple effects. But so we think for everyone, a network, a system of access to private sanitation through public facilities is absolutely essential. Libraries are one of those key locations for people who are unhoused because it's access to the internet and opportunity. it's heat in the winter. It's coolness in the summer. It's the ability to charge a cell phone, because more and more a smartphone is an essential belonging for people who are unhoused. And of course, access to toilets. So we're seeing some really interesting, we found some interesting projects around the country, including one called Lava May in California, which are this group is retrofitting decommissioned school buses, maybe tractor trailers and other things to hold both showers and toilets. And they're mobile, and you move them from site to site, and maybe host a site, like every Tuesday, Lava May is on this site, and a local organization hosts that event. And that I think I saw in Los Angeles where they had barbers and hairdressers coming and doing haircuts, shaves, you know, offering new clothing that might, you know, so that you get new and clean clothing. So once you get out of the shower and have been able to toilet and all that stuff safely, you're not going back into dirty clothes, new shoes, socks, etc. So this is really inspiring for me, and it is my latest campaign.
Just listening, and all of the people that are part of the Mrs. Green's World Tribe, they'll be smiling and saying, this is good news. Finally, Gina's covering something that doesn't make us want to go, like, jump off a building. But it is that, and that is, like, incredibly awesome. And it humanizes the homeless to see them. We see them. Like, I just want to say, I see you. I don't avoid glancing and all that. But I honestly never thought about where they go to the bathroom, because it's never crossed my mind ever. And to just add a little humor to this wonderful subject, my husband and I and my best friend just spent 7 days in Yellowstone. And trust me, when I say we're all over 65, we kind of planned the route around where there were public restrooms, because you're right, the older you get, the more it matters. And, you know, Yellowstone, of course, is very aware of that, and have, you know, restrooms very, very serendipitously or whatever, strategically placed around the park, so that people in the aging population that I have to own, it matters. It just matters. It's not anything you have any control over, so to speak. All of a sudden, I find myself spending more time in public restrooms.
Yes.
So,
and noticing them. So when they're beautiful, too, that can be quite inspiring.
And clean. And it's all so respectful. It's all so respectful, which brings me to the equity question. When there's, and I like the word so much more than equality, when there's equity in the built environment, what does that look like? And doesn't it really mean, this is not just me being, you know, that whacked out progressive, don't we all win when the population is healthier and we are consciously thinking about equity in the built environment? What's the downside?
Well, I think you're asking the wrong person to describe the downside.
There is no downside.
The downside is that we have some political, social hurdles to get over.
Yeah.
But what it looks like, and I'm, you know, I have this post-it on my desk or in my office that says, what does built equity look like? So I'm still exploring
that's question. A tough question.
But I'll tell you one of the things that I campaign for or advocate for is where and what we make our investments. So when we're looking at equity, for instance, you mentioned one side of Broadway has much less tree canopy than another. And it might also be of a lower income, et cetera. So low income people are much more likely to actually depend on public spaces, right?
Yes.
They're walking and biking and using public transit rather than in their own air-conditioned vehicles. And so we need more trees. We would invest in more tree canopy there. And we would invest in better intersection crossing facilities, better sidewalks, et cetera. And the return on that investment to us would be, yes, the kind of, you know, we're all doing better, but we actually save money as a public, as a society, because who bears the cost of disease in our among low-income people? We've made an agreement that people, that we will use our taxes to help care for people who are sick and unable to pay for it. So we are collectively paying for it. We collectively pay for medical services. We collectively pay for the cleanup of those alleys, street corners,
right,
you know, the backs of businesses, et cetera, to be cleaned. We pay for the spread of hepatitis. We pay for managing things like needle pickup or the injuries that come from the lack of picking up injection needles. We pay in our own inconvenience, all the things that we've removed from our built environment in order to somehow, we think, manage behaviors of others. But it just doesn't work like that. We don't stop peeing and pooping because there are no toilets. We don't stop walking because there are no trees if that's how we need to get around. So that's my bottom line. We need toilets and trees.
I love it. The double T's. And I was thinking about when I first moved here decades ago, I had no money. I was making $2.83 an hour. I lived farther out from town because it was less expensive. And I had to take the bus. And when it's 103 or 105 or 107, if you have to spend 2 minutes out there, it's awful. So even trees for public spaces where the bus stops are, I didn't have a sheltered bus stop. So it takes me back to that, where it was awful. And all I wanted to do was work to get a car with air conditioning, so I didn't ever have to do that again. It was a big motivator for me to just get out of that. And it was awful. It was so awful in the summer. And of course, again, I was definitely low income, and it was not fun. If I had a tree to stand under in the shade, what a difference that would have made. So many.
And imagine being 80 in that situation.
Oh my gosh! Like really, really.
So all of these factors are really preventative medicine.
It's the P word.
Yeah,
it's the P word. I worked in mental health for 35 years, and I spent a significant time of that career at the legislature pointing out facts like, do you know how much better investment it is to put money into prevention than it is into prisons? So that's another double P. We'll put all this money, and it wasn't even as bad then with the prisons weren't privatized, but all of the research, all of the data, everything we had about healthy Head Start and all of that says this is like money in the bank. If you put it in prevention, it's money in the bank. And what do we put the majority of our money into? Treatment. Treatment.
Right.
So it's the same thing, and I just I will never honestly, and I'm saying this very sincerely, look at a homeless person the same again, and that's a good thing. It's a good thing for me to think about, and as an activist in my community and in my world, it's a consciousness that you helped me have. So as we gather my thoughts to come to a close, so many times on a show like this one, people email me, they ask me, they reach out, they love the show, and they say, what can I do about the built environment? How can I make a difference when it comes to some of these issues that were discussed that I agree with, that I'd like to be a part of? Do you have any words of wisdom or just some directives of possible calls to action for the people that are part of my world who truly do care about a socially just and sustainable planet? What would you tell us?
Well, thank you for asking that question, Gina. And what I love about trees and toilets is those are two things that are easy for us to advocate for,
yes,
contribute to, and actually realize in our own local communities. These are local actions. I know people often become overwhelmed with the scope and scale of things like global climate change. You know, what can I do today about that? I'm not sure. But trees and toilets are tangible, immediate, and really important elements that we can advocate for in our own community. So what would that look like? For one, I know in Albuquerque, we have a big tree planting campaign now. And the focus really is on those areas that have lost a lot of tree canopy. And with the kind of data that is available now, it's pretty easy to hone in on those areas. And I would advocate for those kinds of changes with local government, but not just local government. There are nonprofits. The Tree People, I think, is a national organization of people who are pro-tree. You can get involved with one of them, either directly by volunteering or indirectly by sending money. And with that money, they purchase trees, they get trees donated, they get them delivered where they're needed. They find people in neighborhoods to adopt trees and steward them. So it's even better, I think, than the city's going to come in and put in 15 street trees, and then we complain 2 years later when those street trees are suffering from the drought conditions or something.
Right.
But when you have a steward, you know, who has that tree as an important feature in their front yard or their backyard, it's really more powerful. They're part of a larger solution in contributing to their community and having a more beautiful environment for themselves. So there are those kinds of projects that are maybe easy to do. Public toilet advocacy is interesting. I'm even trying to figure out how to kind of ratchet up beyond, my soapbox. But I think listening, being ready to vote for that kind of investment in our community, there is a toilet advocacy toolkit available online.
You got to be kidding me. Oh my God. I love it. I love it.
I did not know that these things existed a year ago,
but now we do.
Yes. So those are ways, I would look to the toilet advocacy toolkit. I would, the other thing that I think is really important is, yes, you want to talk to your elected officials and your local government staff to help carry these things forward, but it's definitely not the only place. Grassroots organizations, community organizations, nonprofits are also can be very effective, and sometimes may be the indirect influencers to those policymakers and decision makers at City Hall. So I don't know.
It's just like, be aware.
If you get active with a community organization like Tree People, or if there is one called Toilet People, you're actually socializing and you're interacting with other people and you'll live longer.
Agreed. So agreed. It's just, there's always something somebody can do. And Kelly will get the link for that website about public toilets. I think it's great. And I think that thousands of people who listen to this podcast will be more aware. And now I just want to close with a few words from me, but it's really not a few. So just everybody stay with me, because I had a lot to say about this one when I went on a tear. My friend Mike Franks was right. The Mrs. Green's World platform was missing a critical piece when it came to talking about and educating ourselves about the importance of the built environment. How buildings are designed and built matter to our health because we spend so much time in them, and to the health of the environment because of their air quality, energy, and water use. And that's all good to know. But Michael Pride took me to another level. She's the first guest I've interviewed who brought to light the challenges homeless people have when it comes to having a safe and sanitary place to go to the bathroom. She made me think about how we spend money on art in public places and how I enjoy that, and how I've never once stopped to think about using taxpayers' money to put toilets in public places. I never gave a thought to the environmental health worker thinking about hepatitis outbreaks, or the behavioral health worker who is thinking about safe needle locations. And you can be sure I have never given a thought to calling the police because there's poop in the alley behind my home, because I don't live in the city center where that is an everyday reality. Because of the work and the passion and the leadership of Michael Pride, I will now know. She is the epitome of a disruptor for good, aka good troublemaker. And I can honestly say that my life is better now because I know better and hopefully will do better when it comes to the challenges faced by the homeless people in my community. And I hope you've been impacted as I have. And yes, my voice is cracking a little bit, so just everybody deal with it. As I have said before, we can never have a sustainable planet without a socially just one. Michael Pride is working hard to make sure we get there. Mike Franks, you were right. Michael Pride is a rock star. And I thank you for expanding my world by connecting us. And Michael Pride, I thank you for the important work you're doing, for raising my awareness about toilets and homeless people, and for being a voice for so many people who don't have one or who simply haven't found it yet. I appreciate the time that I've got to spend with you, and I thank you for all you do. And that's all she wrote.
Thank you so much, Dina.
It's been really a pleasure. Amazing, like amazing and fun and informative. And I mean that. And I hope our paths cross. We have two daughters in Taos and three delightful grandchildren, one of whom is just 4 months old. So we go through frequently and are always in a rush to get to Taos to see the kids. But maybe someday it'll work out that we can stop and have lunch, because I'd love to meet you in person.
Oh, I would really enjoy that, Gina. So I'm inviting you to stop in Santa Fe and have a cup of coffee.
So you're in Santa Fe?
Yes.
Oh, lucky you. That's a little bit of heaven. We stop at the Trader Joe's there, so why would we not?
Oh, yeah.
And
so close. I live 2 blocks from the Trader Joe's.
Which has the worst parking lot in the planet, but we don't need to go there on the show. But thank you. It's just, I hope that you've enjoyed it, and thank you for sharing your passion and your wisdom and raising awareness about things we really need to care about as humankind. So thank you.
Well, I'm honored, and I thank you so much for allowing me to stand on my soapbox in your space in Mrs. Green's world.
What a great soapbox to stand on. Thanks, everybody. Go out there and make a difference. We're needed.